Hi there, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind here in WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you live a more positively minded life. My associate in the studio, Stephanie Dombrin, co-hosting with me, researching with me. Hi, Steph.
Hi, Armand.
So this is exciting. Confusing stuff. You know, we're going to talk today about hormones and how hormones relate to addiction. This is a fascinating thing. It's a funny thing because, you know, if you'd ask somebody what's a hormone, they try to answer. Well, it's a thing that you secrete. But we have so many hormones in our body. How many hormones do you think there are, Stephanie? There are digestive hormones. There are steroid hormones.
Yeah, there's several dozen.
Several dozen different hormones.
So it seems like.
Right. And the hormones do all kinds of wild things. Now, the difference between female hormones and male hormones is not as specific as you think. The definition of a hormone is that it's a chemical substance produced by an endocrine gland that has a specific effect on the activity of organs in your body. So you have an endocrine gland that they send out this messenger, and this messenger has the effect on these organs. The major female and male hormones are classified as estrogens and androgens. And they're present in both male and female alike, but different amounts. Most men, for example, produce 6 to 8 milligrams of the male hormone testosterone every day. 6 to 8 milligrams of testosterone a day, every one of us male guys. Compared to women who produce 0.5, that's half of one milligram daily. Female hormones, estrogens, are also present in both sexes. Now, what does this have to do with anything today, and why are we bringing it to you? Well, we're bringing it to you because a very exciting thing came our way through a marvelous person, Emily Anthes. Emily Anthes is a science writer, one I've admired for years. I've followed her and some of her articles. And she wrote an article called She's Hooked, which shows a correlation between women's hormones and addiction. Emily is on the air with us right now. Emily, you're with us?
I am.
Oh, how exciting to have you here.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Well, let's talk a little about it. What do we know about this?
Well, it's interesting. We know that women's hormones, and in particular we're talking about estrogen, can affect how addiction feels, both to women and to how addiction plays out in the brain. And it's interesting because scientists don't have evidence that male hormones influence male addiction. So testosterone doesn't seem to make much difference, but estrogen means that female addicts aren't necessarily like their male counterparts.
Well, then this is going to be very interesting, but very hard to explain. First of all, let's talk about addiction.
Sure.
Addiction. What's the good news about addiction? It was a good question. I was asking. What's good about addiction? What does it do for a human? Why would humans have addiction as part of their evolutionary process? Do you have any ideas?
Well, in terms of evolution, addiction works very closely with the reward circuitry in your brain, and that circuitry is really important. It's what makes you think that food tastes good. It's what makes sex feel good. And there are obvious reasons that the brain would want to be able to tell you that those things are good for you, and that would keep the species alive. Drugs, what they do is they sort of hijack this circuitry. And, you know, the brain is there to tell you that things like food and sex are good, but drugs figure out how to tap into that circuit in the brain and tell you that this drug feels good. So it's sort of hijacking a system that serves a real purpose in the brain.
But for many people, Emily, being able to have some control over your life at all is something. So if a person feels out of control and suddenly they take a drink, and they have a drink every hour, or they drink alcohol every hour, which may be addictive, they are feeling at least control over their system, and that is evolutionarily something that people would strive for. Not necessarily hijacking, at least you have some control.
Right.
You know, so I can see people feeling a need for power, a need to medicate themselves, a need to focus. There are people who are so unfocused that when they get near an addiction, suddenly they become birds. You know, they're searching for it. They're gonna find it. They're gonna get it. They become single focused.
Right. I mean, if you're addicted to something, it certainly gives you something to organize your life around.
And people in chaos tend to want to organize.
Right.
So since there is a tendency under stress to organize, addiction seems like almost a natural evolution, like a process that's available for people who just want to get their minds screwed around. But you have to have a certain powerful mind to do that. You have to have a mind that could find it. Now, herein play these chemicals. Here's where the hormones take place. How do hormones affect the addiction process in men and women?
Well, it's a little bit complicated, but I'll try.
Let's go for it.
We'll walk you through it here. So the first hormone that to talk about is estrogen, which, as you noted, is present in men too, but really it makes more of a difference in women. It's present in higher levels in women, and in women, the presence of the levels of estrogen cycle. So whereas men's hormones tend to be the same from day to day, women fluctuate with the menstrual cycle. And one of the first things that researchers noticed was that female rats, they work a lot with rodents, seem to be more responsive to certain drugs. Cocaine is something that's often used in these studies, than male rats. But also that their response to drugs varied across the menstrual cycle. And so that clued them in right away to estrogen, which is what varies. And they started finding that if you take estrogen away from these rats, they don't respond as quickly to drugs. And if you give it back, their response to drugs is supplemented or increases. And so what this means is when estrogen was present in the brain, that drugs feel better, that they're more addictive, that it's harder to quit.
So estrogen would be more present right after a woman's period, the first 15 days after her period, is that right?
Right, the first half of the cycle is dominated by estrogen.
So a woman who is in that period, if she went to a bar and some guy said, have a little cocaine, she is more likely to take to it, you're saying, than she might at another time.
Right, and she would probably, after these studies with rodents, there have been studies with humans, and she's probably more likely to say, that feels really good, I really like that cocaine, during that phase of her cycle.
And I really like that cocaine, and I'd like a little more.
Right. I mean, the point is that it's noticeable to her. It's not some subtle brain thing. It is going on in the brain, but she would feel a difference.
So if she is at her lowest ebb of estrogen, right, which may be during her period?
That's where it gets a bit complicated.
We men like to simplify.
Yes. The estrogen, of course, isn't the only hormone at work in our bodies, as you mentioned, and it's also not the only hormone that fluctuates throughout the cycle. It works with another hormone called progesterone. And progesterone, it seems like the latest work is focused on progesterone, can actually block some of the effects of estrogen and addiction. So if you give a mouse estrogen, she'll be more responsive to cocaine. But if you give her estrogen with progesterone, if you give those two together, there is no enhanced effect. So it looks like what's happening is that progesterone can counteract the effects of estrogen.
Wow.
And so what happens in the first half of the menstrual cycle is dominated by estrogen. Estrogen is high and progesterone is low. What happens in the second half is estrogen doesn't necessarily get low, but the level of progesterone rises. So suddenly you have this contradictory effect that's pulling back on the estrogen and canceling out some of estrogen's effects.
Wow, this is fascinating because I could just see the drug companies running to the manufacturer right away. Look at what we invented. Look at how we can control this. Look, we can come up with a new chemical to help control addiction.
Right.
By making sure that women have their hormones corrected.
Right. And, you know, most of the work so far has just been on finding this observation, but now there are some scientists doing studies where they're actually giving addicts progesterone and seeing how that influences their perception of drug use. And the studies are preliminary, but it looks encouraging that if you give, I believe it was heroin addicts in one of these studies, some extra progesterone, the drug doesn't feel as good. And the theory is that maybe that would make it easier to quit. And what's really interesting, I think, is they've also done studies saying, well, if progesterone can do this in women, let's give progesterone to male addicts too. And it seems to have no effect on men whatsoever. So this would be, if it pans out, a female-specific treatment. And researchers aren't quite sure why it doesn't work in men, but you know, that's something they're trying to unravel as well.
What's interesting, Emily, is that I know progesterone does work when there's some brain trauma. I've read some studies and some research about when there's a brain trauma, I think to men as well. So I'm going to have to further do some research. But do you know anything about that?
I don't know about that research. I mean, progesterone is present in men, and it plays a real role in their functioning in lots of ways. So it's been a bit of a surprise to researchers that it doesn't seem to play this role in male addiction, but, you know, they think it could, if estrogen is so active in the reward circuit, it could be something specific about how high levels of estrogen are interacting with the progesterone. They're not quite sure, but they know the hormones are calibrated differently in men and women, and so it might have something to do with those relative levels.
My guest is Emily Anthes, science writer, researcher. We're talking about hormones, and we're talking specifically about estrogen and the addictive process, some recent discoveries in the latest scientific mind, or the Science American mind. Emily wrote this story. It is a story. Emily, what's happened with teenagers and addiction recently? Is it going up? Is it going down? What's happening?
Well, what's interesting, the levels change a bit from year to year, and there's been a slow, like sort of moderate downward trend in use, but one year it'll go down a little and the next year it'll go up. Overall, there doesn't seem to be a big change in the total number of teenagers using, but what's really interesting is that the gender gap is closing. So for a long time, and still sort of across the general population, men have been more likely to use drugs than women, and that was true of adults, and that was true of teenagers. And that's becoming less true, and particularly that's being driven by what's happened in the 13 to 18-year-old age group, in which the gender gap is pretty much closed for the first time ever in the last few years. Girls have been using drugs just as often and just as frequently as boys. Those levels have normalized.
Well, it's not that they've changed their hormones. It's just that they've changed their attitudes.
Right. Well, researchers think that what's driving that is sort of an increased acceptance of, in terms of lessening of social stigma. If you think back to, mm-hmm. you know, a few decades ago, there was much more stigma if women drank than if men drank. And that sort of extended more recently to, it was not as socially acceptable in high schools for women to be drug users as it was for men to be. And that sort of stigma has faded away. I guess maybe the dark side of gender equality, but, you know, girls also, they think, have more opportunities to score drugs, and they're, you know, trying to figure out why that is and what's behind that.
And so the reward system of being provided drugs in exchange for intimacies and sex and things like that, that's more common. So now the women are out there, mostly college-age women and high school women, Now you're saying something else, though. You know, it's not like we're just giving, we're introducing something new. For women, they are far more vulnerable to addiction as a process than we thought they were. Women who are in that phase, women who have high estrogen or at their high estrogen point, are very vulnerable to true addiction. And we're not talking about usage.
Right. And that's sort of a double-pronged problem, is it really seems to be social factors that are giving women more opportunities to use. But once they use, these biological factors kick in and sort of lead them to escalate and become dependent far more quickly than we thought.
So what are you suspecting? Is there going to be a way to stop this or interfere with this thing? Because it sounds like it could be a vulnerability that women don't know about.
Right. Well, I mean, the first piece of good news is that researchers are now aware of it. You know, for a long time, research on addiction focused mostly on men, and treatment programs have been designed for men, and drugs that treat addiction or help curb withdrawal symptoms have been designed for men. And so now that we just know that women are different, period, in terms of addiction, you're seeing more emphasis in terms of designing female-centric rehab programs and also in terms of looking at all sorts of drugs that might help women with their withdrawal symptoms or with addiction, things like progesterone, that never would have been considered in men because maybe those substances don't work in men. So there's a real interest now in looking at how we can help women get off drugs.
Well, a very interesting part of your article that I read was something about a mention about smoking.
Right.
You know, now smoking is one of those addictions that every one of us try to stop at some point or other if we were smokers. I was a smoker once. And I remember my experience. I had this incredible experience where one day I just stopped smoking. And it wasn't like I said, I'm going to stop smoking. It was one day I stopped.
Right.
See, now, and then there were other days that I said that to myself, and I fought it, and I fought it, and I fought it. And I've seen this with other people. It's almost like there's a time. There is timing in the body when your body says, oh, now's a good time. Now, relate cigarette smoking to what you're saying about women's cycles and around estrogen.
Sure. Well, I have no doubt that all sorts of bodily physiological factors might make certain times better for quitting than others. But the one that I talk about in my article and that scientists have looked at recently involves this menstrual cycle phenomenon, where if we know that drugs are more rewarding during the first half of the cycle when estrogen is high and less rewarding during the second half, then maybe that would make a difference in quitting. And in fact, that's what researchers found. They had some 200 women, and they had asked half of them to try and quit during the first half of the cycle and half of them to try and quit during the second half. And women who gave up smoking during the second half of their cycle, and that's when progesterone is counteracting the effects of estrogen, were more successful, and a month later they were more likely to still be abstaining from smoking. So what that means is that if smoking is more rewarding during the first half, maybe you're getting more of a kick from your cigarettes during that part of your cycle and it feels better, which makes it harder to give them up. If it doesn't feel as good, it might be easier to abstain from cigarettes.
Mm-hmm. Might that suggest that menopause becomes an opportunity for a lot of addictions to change because of hormonal changes that might take place during that time with reductions in estrogen? Stephanie, what do you think?
Well, I was thinking that very thing with menopause, that I wonder if women are able to
get... You were thinking the same thing when I was thinking it?
Well, I was thinking about that, and there's a double-edged sword here of what I'm going to say, because this is where the pharmaceutical companies come in. But think about the birth control pill in teenagers. If you give oral contraceptives, you are leveling out the estrogen. Is that not right, Emily?
That's true.
So I wonder if studies are being done, or we'll look into this to see if... you can tell that women or young girls are less addicted to substances while they take oral contraceptives.
That's a good question.
That's a good question.
I'm not sure it would be that simple. I mean, some birth controls, different brands and different formulations have, you know, some just affect estrogen, some affect testosterone. I mean, I think it's definitely some interesting things to be found there, though. I'm not sure exactly what the results would be.
But think of the advantage. Think of the advantage of menopause being the beginning of a time when you can start shedding a lot of your addictions. And I know many women who have gone through menopause who just find themselves not addicted to relationships as much, not addicted to sex, not addicted to drugs. They make changes in their bodies. They get on health regimens. And maybe it's because of hormonal changes that allow the addictions not to click into the place they used to.
Yeah, that's certainly possible.
The good news.
It's an interesting question for further research, that's for sure.
The good news. You were going to say, Stephanie?
No, good.
All right, so if you're, the other rewards, money, food, and sex, also change during a menstrual cycle, don't they?
They do, and that's a less studied area, but I think it's one that's going to explode. There was a study in 2007 that sort of found the same thing that we found with cigarettes, and it was focusing on money. And again, during the first half of the menstrual cycle, when women have a lot of estrogen and not much progesterone to counteract it, monetary rewards felt more rewarding. And, you know, there's no reason. All the reward circuitry in the brain is sort of nonspecific. It's for anything that's rewarding. So there's reason to think that food would also be more rewarding, sex would be more rewarding, and those studies haven't been done yet, at least to my knowledge, but I think they're coming. And it's a broader issue than just addiction. It has to do with how we process things in the world and things that we find pleasurable.
You're part of your curiosity, Emily, and some, as I've followed your writings, you're a neuroscientist in your own way. You appreciate neuroscience. Has much of this come from the study of neuroscience?
Well, I should say I have no neuroscience degree. I've always been, I guess, an amateur student of it. I find it fascinating, and I've, you know, taken a lot of classes in it, but I have no, you know, official expertise other than just being, you know, a student and following these developments. So I haven't done my own research.
Okay, but what led you? What do you find fascinating about neuroscience in general? Because most people, when we say the word neuroscience, they almost don't know what we're talking about. Could you explain what it is?
Sure. Well, actually, I started with an interest in psychology, and that started young when I was in school. It was sort of a revelation to discover that there was this field that tried to explain what people did and what was going on inside them. And that sort of led me to this field where scientists, you know, aren't just relying on what people report or what they say or sort of how they act, which are all important things. I don't mean to denigrate that. But then going to say, okay, well, this is how they're acting. That must be due to some internal process. Let's go into the brain and find out, you know, when you say you feel sad or when you say that smoking feels good, what small cellular changes are going on that give rise to that feeling? And they must come from somewhere. And so to sort of try and unravel the biological counterpart of those messy things like feelings and behaviors is what neuroscience is all about. And, you know, the idea that there can be, you know, something in some tiny little cell can give rise to a really complex feeling, that's what I find fascinating.
Something in a tiny cell inside the brain that's imaged, that we could see through a magnetic resonance image, is that the way it's done?
That's often the way it's done is, you know, you put someone in an MRI machine and neuroscientists often ask them to do some task. So they'll put a little screen above them and ask them to play a game or to look at words. Or in the case of one of these studies I talk about, you know, they do a gambling task where they can win real money. And while they're doing this, they're taking tons and tons and tons of pictures of little slices of the brain. And so they can pinpoint exactly, aha, when you won money, this part of your brain was working overtime. It must be involved in processing rewards. So they can see actually what your brain is doing while you're engaged in certain behaviors.
And that took it out of the theoretical, which we would believe, you know, things that happened because they happened, and brought it into an almost physical explanation. Like, I remember discovering some of the neuroscience research on the anterior cingulate gyrus having activity because somebody was a hoarder.
Right.
And I said, oh, my gosh almighty, you can see it right over there. And so when they stimulated the anterior cingulate gyrus, the person who was a hoarder tended to hoard less.
Right.
And I said, so there we have it. There we have a target that we can now see. And it's not just a theory. It's something that gives us an image. Is there any downside to the neuroscientific approach? Is there? Are we missing the emotions? Are we forgetting about humanity? Is love disappearing?
Well, I don't know if I would call it a downside, but I think, you know, when you read these studies and you hear about this research, you need to sort of take it with a grain of salt. And I guess one of the criticisms sometimes is that it's a very reductionist approach. So you say, aha, this area lights up when you're in love. Love is only this little cell right here. And, you know, I think some people worry that it simplifies really complex phenomena. And the other thing is that I think sort of as a society, we find images very compelling. So if you can show a study of something and says, show what parts of the brain light up, that's very seductive. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's the whole answer. It can raise as many questions as it answers, and it can be an interesting place to look for further research. But just knowing where something happens in the brain doesn't necessarily lead you to fully understand a phenomenon.
I have a dear friend who just came back from a trip in Africa where she was just all over the place on seeing every animal. And I think of the human brain as kind of like that. It's like the biggest survey in the world. It's like the most exciting adventure we could take.
Right.
It's fascinating. Now I want to bring back to you, we're talking with Emily Anthons. By the way, if you wanted to get a copy of this article, you could get the Scientific American Mind, a magazine that's on the stand now, or you could go to Emily Anthes, ANTHES.com, and look at her website. But Emily's going to stick with us because when we come back from our break, we're going to talk about men at a level that we haven't talked about men before. And as an introduction to this, I want to say the following. For a little period of time, I was studying depression among women who were getting abortions. And what I would find is a woman would get an abortion and then there would be some depression that would follow it. But what I discovered was that the mates of the women who got abortion, the men, had sometimes a deeper depression that they couldn't get out of. And when we started doing some research with them and talking with them, we found that they felt like they had lost something even greater. So this becomes a very interesting thing. How does the male, how does the father carry some kind of a chemical reaction inside him that doesn't just quit automatically? The family guy is the guy we're talking about, the father, the parent. When we get back from our break, Emily Anthes is going to take us on a trip about men who go through their own biological changes after the baby is born. And we're going to talk about that. So we will be back with you in just a little bit. Emily, you'll stick with us?
Of course.
This is fabulous. We're really enjoying it. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. We're going to take a short break, and we're going to be back with you in just a couple of minutes. That's my transition music. A good friend of mine, Anatole Garazmov, did this piece for me. Hey, friends. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind here in WBAI. We're talking with Emily Anthes. Emily is a science writer. Stephanie Dombra in the studio with me. We're talking about men and some new things that we've learned about men. Men as fathers, something usually not discussed. So let's talk about the father brain, the daddy brain. Emily, welcome back.
Thank you.
Good. Take it over.
Let's see, where to start. I guess I got interested in this work on fathers because for a long time the research on dads was about deadbeat dads or absent dads or what happened to kids when dads weren't around. And I was interested in some of the research coming out that showed what happened to kids when dads were around, and also what happened to men when they were fathers, which had until recently been sort of an overlooked area of research that, you know, fatherhood doesn't just influence the kids, it can really change men as well. And one of the slightly counterintuitive findings that's been emerging over the last decade or so is that fatherhood can change men's bodies and brains. It's obvious that motherhood does so for women. It's less obvious why someone who isn't carrying a child would have these changes. Even things like gaining weight while their wives or female partners are pregnant, men, expectant fathers, tend to gain a lot of weight. And it's not necessarily because they're just matching their wives' craving for craving. There are actually hormonal changes that prompt them to gain weight, and their metabolism to slow down. And the theory, you know, the evolutionary theory is that, you know, raising a child is so costly and requires so much energy that it makes sense for men to store all these calories when they have a kid on the way.
So changes. Men go through a lot of different changes.
Right. And so it can be as simple as gaining weight, but there are also some brain changes as well. You know, we've been talking about hormones, and for instance, one of the interesting findings is that in the first few weeks after a man becomes a father, his testosterone levels can drop by as much as a third. And, you know, there's evolutionary speculation about why that might be. You know, testosterone is often a hormone that accompanies aggression and sex. And so one of the theories is if testosterone drops, the man doesn't have to spend as much time out fighting rivals or seducing other women, and it sort of keeps him closer to home, which would be an advantage for his children.
What other changes do they go through?
There's also a change in a hormone called prolactin, which is a pretty important hormone in mothers. It's what actually causes women to start lactating, but dads, in expectant fathers and new fathers, have elevations in this same hormone as well. And it's been shown that higher levels of this hormone are higher in men and women who are sort of responsive and attentive to their children. And there seems to be a correlation between prolactin levels in parenting, and in men it's starting to be called one of the parenting hormones.
Well, isn't prolactin also the hormone that kind of makes you distance yourself from your mate sexually? Doesn't it push you away? I know that after an orgasm, there's prolactin becomes present in men, and it's what makes up for the fact that the man wants to have a cheeseburger after having sex or something. They've talked about
that.
Yeah, it's an aversion. It's an aversion to intimacy. It may be something that leads you to children. But now look at the facts of what's going on here. We have men having increased prolactin, which means a little more aversion, lower testosterone, which means less of a sex drive, and we have the women having less of a sex drive with their husbands because they're taking care of their children. And these poor kids who just had a baby are looking at each other and they're saying, I wonder why I don't love him as much as I used to. I wonder why I don't feel the way I used to. They get this confusion, but they look at each other and they say, well, I guess it's because we just had a baby, and they turn their focus on the children. And so the children become the focus, and the children wind up in bed, and the children wind up being the place. But most people have no idea what's going on physically, hormonally, chemically. If they did, they would say to each other, look, let's make sure we get at least a weekend alone together, or let's make sure we spend a night together, or let's do something a little different, or let's have grandma come over and take the kids for a night. So what happens is I think that men and women tend to distance themselves a little from each other during that early phase of having a baby. And sometimes I think the lack of knowledge and information about it leads to something that's not recoverable.
Right. Though you could argue, I mean, it depends what degree and how long you're talking about, but, you know, you could certainly argue that during the first few weeks of a child's life that that makes a lot of sense, and that, you know, having both partners totally focused on this new creature is a good thing.
Sure.
And I don't know if you studied this, but I'm sure oxytocin is flooding both the parents, and that connection and their desire to hug and cuddle and take care of the baby, even though all these other hormones are off, probably oxytocin is driving a lot of this behavior.
Right. That's another big one, the sort of the love or the cuddle hormone. And, you know, one of the interesting things is that the hormonal changes in men pretty closely mirror what's going on in women, and those changes have been more widely studied and documented, but it's only more recently that researchers have figured out that the same biological things are going on in new fathers.
The same biological things as what?
As the hormonal changes happening in mothers.
Okay, so now we have an interesting society. We have a world where women are becoming more vulnerable to addiction, and men are becoming more vulnerable to being daddies and stay-at-home dads. And it almost seems like there's a reversal of the sexes that seems to be taking place. It seems like the women are stepping into a more what used to be identified as male role of maybe the addiction process, and the men are stepping more into the female role or the woman's role, you know? The maternal role.
Right. I mean, I don't think it goes nearly so far as a reversal of sex roles. I think that there is an equalizing that's happened. So, you know, more men are staying home. It's actually single father households are the fastest growing type of household in the U.S., but they still vastly are outnumbered by single mother households. And the same thing with sort of women in addiction. I think both genders are sort of coming in toward the middle, but I don't think they've gone so far yet as to reverse.
Do men suffer postpartum depression?
They do, and that's been one of the interesting findings over the last few years, too, especially because you never hear it talked about, and it seems like that's something that both men and women should be on the lookout for.
Well, since never is going to stop right now, let's talk about it. What is it?
It looks a lot like female postpartum depression.
Let's identify that first. Let's identify what a postpartum depression is.
Sure. It's sort of profound. It shares a lot of traits with regular sort of major depression. It's a profound sense of hopelessness or loneliness or feelings of worthlessness, any of that stuff sort of immediately following the birth of the baby. And sometimes it can be so severe as to put the baby's life in danger. These are women you occasionally see on the news who have drowned their newborns because they feel so overwhelmed with the new responsibility and don't feel bonded and attached. And usually it does not go to that extreme, but it can put a lot of stress on a family and on a new child. And it's a problem that practitioners know to look out for and how to identify in women.
So it's a serious thing. And I was talking a little earlier about what I would see when I was working with the people who were studying the abortions.
Right.
They would find that women who had abortions had a tendency to have a depression following the abortion, but the men had a post-abortion depression.
Right.
And that nobody expected because they figured, well, you know, you're not invested. You're just barely there, man.
Right.
But when a woman becomes pregnant, a man goes through hormonal changes immediately. And it's hard to believe, but it's easy to see among our feathered animals, you know, our friends. We could see it in nature. But men go through changes, and you can see men going through changes. You can see them while the woman is pregnant. You can see the men change. They become different. They behave differently. They think differently. So then, when the child is born, a man is not the guy he used to be. He usually is the guy he used to be plus something else.
Right.
Right? Something new has kind of come along.
There are actually sort of two parts to this understanding of postpartum depression in fathers. And the first is what you're mentioning, this hormonal part, and, you know, along with the finding that men's hormones change, if that's true, which we now know it is, then it certainly seems like these hormonal changes can cause the same mood disturbances that it causes in women. But in addition to that, there are also researchers who are now probing, for instance, postpartum depression in adoptive parents. And so these are mothers who have not gone through pregnancy and delivery and don't have this same hormonal roller coaster, and yet they can also experience postpartum depression. So there's a component of it that's also due just to a change in role and lifestyle, and suddenly you have this creature in your life that you're responsible for, and you wonder if you're ever going to have time alone again or for yourself again. And so sometimes postpartum depression can be just triggered by this sort of crisis of identity that parenthood can cause.
Well, it certainly is a crisis of identity. You know, if you're a mother, you've got 18 years are gone. You just got to give it up for a number of years, you know? You say, okay, I had my baby, and that's it.
Right.
For a good long while. No more taking a trip to San Francisco and just getting on a bus and seeing what it's like to ride around there. No more of that for a while. I've got this baby to take care of.
Mm-hmm.
And it does kind of park your wanderlust, you know, and it puts it in a certain place. And that, in a way, has a potential cloud, which is balanced by this other thing, which is the joy of a baby being there.
Right.
And you hope they balance.
Right. And of course, you know, just as not all women suffer from postpartum depression, not all men have these problems, but enough do that practitioners really need to look at. There's actually an interesting program that started in the UK where people, nurses and practitioners on the OBGYN ward of a hospital are trained to sort of look over the fathers and make sure they're adjusting well and give the fathers there's a men-only postpartum depression hotline, and just sort of make people aware of the fact that, you know, you need to be on the lookout for this in men, too. And I think we're going to start seeing more of those programs.
You know what I find difficult, Emily? I find difficult a man understanding what his role is as a father when he's close to the baby and the toddlers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is he supposed to be a replacement for mommy, or is he supposed to be his own guy? You know, very often the mothers will tell him, no, don't handle the children that way, don't talk to the children that way, don't be rough with them that way. They expect the man to be a second mother.
Right.
A second mom. And is it okay that they're different according to what you've seen? Is the difference important? Is it important that a man is a man in his own way with his child and the mother is the mother? Is there a difference in the way they play?
Right. Well, I guess the first thing I would say is that there's no supposed to. There's no, at least that we know of, better parenting style in some way than another. But there happen to be, researchers have observed, a lot of style differences in male parenting and female parenting. And that doesn't necessarily mean we have to maintain those, but you mentioned play, and for instance, one of the things that researchers talk about, how one researcher explained it to me, which is a really interesting and illuminative metaphor, is that mothers are often lifeguards for a child. They're the ones watching over when they go in the water and saying, are you okay? I hope you're safe. Don't do that. That's dangerous. And so while you have women that are lifeguards, you often have men that are so-called cheerleaders. They're the ones saying to their kids, get on that bike, you can do it. And they're less likely to intervene when their kids are doing, like, homework and they're stuck on a problem. Moms are likely to give help, where dads are more likely to say, you can do it, and encourage kids to solve it themselves. Dads have sort of a rougher, more unpredictable play style that is thought to destabilize children in a productive way, and because the world's not always a safe and predictable place, and so it's thought that sort of horsing around and roughhousing and that sort of play can prepare children for unpredictability in the world. And dads are willing to let, for the most part, kids take more risks, and so that's where they're sort of cheerleading their kids on while the mom comes home from work and says, I can't believe you let him ride his bicycle by himself. And of course, those are general differences, but they've been observed across a wide variety of populations.
It seems really important that the men and women appreciate the other person's contribution and not try to find, it isn't just be like me, keep our child safe.
Right.
And or the opposite of that, which is let's make the child take all risks.
Right.
You know, and let's send the kid out with a dollar and have them buy their own lunch when they're 2 years old.
Right. I mean, we're not talking about, for the most part, negligence here by fathers. It's a subtle thing, but it's, you know, encouraging kids to do something that might be just a little beyond their responsibility, which, you know, you don't want a child who's coddled all the time and, you know, has their lunch made for them into their 30s. So it's a fine balance.
Emily, I thought it was very interesting what you pointed out about how you were able to test the baby's heart rate and comfort when they were picked up by their mother, that everything kind of calmed down in them. The research shows when the mother holds the baby, all those, you know, calming chemicals go down. And then when they were held by the father, everything got stimulated.
Right.
That is very interesting, and it shows what the baby can even anticipate within 6 months of age. Was that,
I think? Yeah, it's pretty early, and it's, you know, especially because when you think about how much sort of soothing and caretaking women are doing during the early months, you know, they're breastfeeding, they're rocking. Often when dad gets the baby, the baby's up and it's time to play or bounce around, and the baby learns this association really quickly. So when dad picks him up, he knows it's time to play. When mom picks him up, he sort of settles down and is ready to nap. And it's pretty quick and impressive how fast these babies learn to do this.
You did some work with you studied Kelly Lambert's work?
Yes.
Yes, could you talk a little bit about that? That was kind of exciting stuff.
And you're talking about the male,
yes,
mice and the testosterone?
Yes.
So this is work that shows, again, we're back to hormones, which is where we started, but perhaps that's fitting.
It's where we're going to end, too. It's where we begin and where we end.
All right. Well, it's nice and circular then.
Right. Perfect.
So one of the ways we've learned this is, although most species in the wild, you know, the dads are total deadbeat fathers, they never have anything to do with their kids, there are some monogamous species of mammals where the dads are sort of superstars and they pitch in too. And one of these species is a certain kind of deer mice. The males of that species are really amazing. When their partners are giving birth, they help sort of deliver the pups. It's kind of incredible to see these creatures do this. But
how do they do that?
I'm not entirely sure. I mean, they're not there with their forceps, you know. But
some version of it. They've got, you know, they've got claws, I know.
I mean, they're not really pulling the pups out, but they help as the pups are coming out. They're cleaning them, and they're sort of cleaning up the birth mess, and they take the pup right away and sort of, they wipe, like, the mucus out of their eyes and nostrils so they can breathe. It's pretty amazing what they've been programmed to do.
I want to see a movie of this.
Yeah.
This will be on YouTube soon, right? But go ahead. You were talking about that.
Sure. Well, these mice, they've actually shown when they're taking care of youngsters, they have enhancements in their brain. It's sort of taking care of kids actively, or these pups, causes these rodents' brains to be more connective. They make new connections between their brain cells and to be more responsive to some of those parenting hormones we were talking about. And there's a difference between the males that have had pups and the males that haven't. And it's sort of the daddy brain showing how being a caretaker can boost brain power.
Well, you mean once having been a caretaker, once having been a father, you seem to, or they seem to have more brain power than not having had a baby?
Well, yes, roughly. That's sort of a rough way of putting it. But when you're actually, I'm not sure if the changes are permanent. I don't think they've shown that yet. But when males are actively caring for a youngster, they have sort of supercharged brains. and compared to bachelors who have never had puffs. It's not entirely clear how long these changes last, but we know it's while they have sort of dependent young ones.
It kind of makes so much sense when you think about it, even in the human world. When right. you think about hiring someone, and you think about how employers would much prefer to have someone who's a parent. Now, one would say, oh, yeah, because they want stability. Well, maybe what they're doing unconsciously is selecting for a higher level of intelligence or a different level of intelligence that gets released by the very fact that you are a parent. That maybe as a parent, parts of your brain become active that would lie dormant if you weren't a parent. And so, therefore, working in business, creating, doing a business where you might be creative, might have a little additional oomph because you know about parenting.
Right, and in particular, they find that these changes are concentrated in the very front part of the brain, an area called the prefrontal cortex, which is involved in things like planning and decision-making. And if you think about the skills you need to raise a kid, I mean, a lot of planning and decision-making that goes into that. So you could see where having enhancements in those areas might pay off.
So I can see why Steve Jobs would want to hire parents. He'd say, hey, you got any kids? Come work for me, because you're going to be more creative and you're going to have more of that potential intuitiveness and intelligence. Very interesting concept. I think our next step is going to be to study in men. If there is what the difference ability is between men who have parented and men who have not.
Right. The brain studies so far have only been done in some primates and in some rodents. But, you know, it's hard to go in and take a slice of a male human's brain. So, but that's next.
But through the imaging, we could see a great deal.
Right, right. Yes. That's what's coming next.
How wonderful. Our guest, Emily Anthes. Probably we could talk forever. But we are running out of time. The issue is Scientific American Mind. You can go to the website emilyanthes.com and see a whole bunch of her stuff. She seems to have one of these very fertile minds. And, you know, just keeps coming up with stuff. And Emily will be back with us another time to do more programming here on The Positive Mind. Thank you very much for being with us, Emily.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
A pleasure.
Thank you, Emily.
Well, Steph, there we go. See? One more of the many scientists. What does it do when you see this? Do you? It's so exciting, isn't it?
Oh, it's already enhancing my mind, Armand.
Already, right?
It does. Just to hear and learn new things. Always, I love it. Good information.
So we were talking about estrogen and testosterone in general. We're talking about the importance of estrogen. Estrogen is very important for women's hormones. For men, they seem to have no known function, the estrogens. They supposedly work somewhere around the...
They lubricate the reproductive tract.
Lubricate the reproductive tract.
Whatever that means.
Whatever that means. Well, we're learning. Hormones, people, babies, mamas. This is Armand DeMille with you with Stephanie Dombra. We will be back with you tomorrow. And we'll be... And if you want to get a copy of today's program or you want to hear it again, go to thepositivemind.com, my friends.